So, you know, I'm going to talk to you about worship in difficult times, and I always look online and try to find an image that doesn't seem to have a copyright associated with it, because I have a little bit of a conscience in that area. And I found this image by searching for the words suffering, sorrow, and despair, those kinds of words. And you see, this person looks like they're kind of going through it, doesn't it? They're kind of having a hard time just sitting there with their head in their hands, so to speak. And I want to talk to you about those kinds of times. I'd like to ask you, if you would, to open your Bibles to the book of Job. If you didn't bring your own Bible, there might be a Bible in a seat near you. And Job is on page 496 on that. And there's also a Bible app event for this. It'll have scriptures on it that you can follow along if you'd like to. What I want to posit to you this morning, what I want to suggest to you this morning, is that worship is something that can really help us win battles. In fact, it's kind of a tool of warfare. Do you know people who have been in a spiritual battle in their life and they just lost? And it seems they lost everything. Do you know people like that? And when I say lost everything, I'm not talking about they lost their house or their car or whatever. I'm talking about they lost their faith. Have you had people in your life like that? I can remember when Laurel and I were in college studying for ministry, some of our best friends were Herb and Ethel. That's not their real names. I borrowed that from I Love Lucy. I'm not going to tell their real names. But Herb and Ethel were great friends. They were very different from Laurel and me, from a different part of the country, a lot more adventurous than we were. But we had many, many things in common. We used to go door to door and invite people to church because we belonged to a little tiny Alliance church, and we did that with Herb and Ethel. That was fun. Can you imagine Laurel Shields going door to door inviting people to church? That is just not part of her personality, but we had a great time doing that. We used to go on Sunday nights after church. We used to go to Dairy Queen, you know. And I can remember Ethel would say, "Herb, I really need ice cream," you know. And that was, oh, I loved hearing those words. And off we'd go. They had a Yamaha. We had a Yamaha. And we used to go riding with them and up and down the mountains of North Georgia. Those were great, great times together. And we were just good friends. We played games together and did everything that you do with good friends. One time, over Christmas break, Herb and Ethel went home to their home church, and his pastor said, "Herb, you have lost a lot of weight since September." And Herb said, "Really? I guess I'm fit." And the pastor said, "No, something's wrong. You need to go to the doctor." And he went to the doctor, and he found out that he had diabetes. And the kind of diabetes he had was of such a nature that at that time it would have precluded him doing his life's desire. And their life desire was to be missionaries in a third world country. That's why they were there at school. They were studying to serve God. They were studying to go overseas. They were studying to do the work of the ministry. They'd given up so much to come here and to do this. And now something happens physically in Herb's body that he can't. And they were devastated. They left school and never came back. They asked those hard questions. "God, how can you let this happen? Don't you know we're helping you? God, why would you do this to someone who loves you? God, who are you that you would do such a thing as this?" And it didn't end well. They went back home and lived together for a couple decades, divorced, and lost the spiritual battle. And that Ethel never recovered. She's so bitter and angry, 50-some years of age. She's turned her back on God. Now, through the years, I've known a lot of Herb and Ethels, and maybe you have too, people who in the midst of suffering said, "I've had it," and turned their back on God. And they lose the battle when they do that. While this was happening to Herb and Ethel, I happened to be reading a book, and it was a book by Philip Yancey, I think it was his first one, "Where is God When It Hurts?" And he makes this statement in the introduction to the book, "I've Made It to You Before." After an extensive tour of the United States, the well-known German pastor and theologian Helmut Thielicke was asked what he observed as the greatest deficiency among American Christians. Okay, now think of that for a minute. Here's a guy who knows the Bible, he knows theology, he knows doctrine, he's well-respected. Whoever that guy is in your mind, like that guy that you say, "Wow, that guy knows the Bible, that guy knows theology," it's probably me. Whoever that is in your mind, okay, he comes and visits your country. And so when he's getting on the plane to leave, you say, hey, by the way, is there anything we ought to examine in our lives? What is the greatest deficiency among American Christians? He replied, they have an inadequate view of suffering. Huh. How about that? Yes, he continues, I've come to agree with him. Now, the quintessential example of suffering in all of Scripture would probably be a gentleman named Job. And your text is open. We're going to read this in a few minutes. But before we do that, I want to talk about your understanding of Job. You see, because I didn't understand the depths of the lessons in Job, I can remember as a kid, honestly, I felt the story of Job was kind of lame. I did. I thought the lesson of Job was, well, you know, if you lose your children, if you lose your animals, if you lose your crops, if you lose your wealth, if you lose your resources, don't worry. What God takes away, he'll give it back multiplied. That was kind of the takeaway that I had on the story of Job. And I'm not stupid. I mean, if you look at the closing words of the book of Job, you kind of, I think a lot of people get that idea because it ends with the phrases, with words like this. After Job had prayed for his friends, the Lord restored to him the fortunes, his fortunes, and gave him twice as much as he had before. And then it goes on to detail that, and it ends by saying, and Job died an old man full of years. And kind of a naive and natural conclusion that one might get to that would be, that's the message. God gives more than he ever takes, so when he takes something, don't worry. If that's the message, there's a serious problem there. And you know there's a serious problem there, even when you're a little kid. I've told you about my dog, Bucky. I had a little beagle pup named Bucky, and he got run over by a tractor trailer. Dead, right? I'm just a little kid, right? And I'm doing what a little kid does, crying. And I was good at crying when I was little, you know? And I was crying. And my brother Dave, who was 9 years older than me, probably just wanted to shut me up. And you know what he said? I've told you this story before. He said, don't worry, Dad and Mom will get you another dog. You know my answer, right? I don't want another dog. I want Bucky. And that's kind of how I felt about the book of Job. What kind of lesson is that? I don't get that. But I want to say this to you. The lesson of the book of Job is not expressed in the closing verses of the book, but in the closing chapters. And you can really see it clearly toward the end. You see, throughout the book of Job, Job has been kind of talking to his buddies about what he'd like to do. And he doesn't sin and blame God, but he does say, I would really like to have a talk with God. If only the Almighty would listen to me. If only I could talk with him. I got some questions. I got some questions I'd kind of like to ask him, right? And toward the end, the Almighty shows up. And he says to Job things like this, who is this that obscures my plans without words of knowledge? And if I was Job, I'd be like, oh, it wasn't me. I think it was Eliphaz. It's not me, right? And then God says, brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. The lesson of the book of Job begins by understanding that dialogue that God has with Job. When he asks questions like, so the Leviathan and the great creature of the sea, did you make them or did I? So the snow that falls on the ground, are you the one who stores that in storehouses above, or do I do that? Surely you know, Job, because you're so wise. And when I hear God saying, Job, you think you're able to question me? Yeah, go ahead, but let me question you first. I see that the message of the book of Job could be summarized in a tweet. And I got to tell you, if you can summarize something in 140 characters, that's pretty good. It would go like this. If I were to tweet it, it would say, God is God. We are not God. Because God is God, it is right and proper to worship him at all times. That's the message of the book of Job. God is God. We are not God. And because God is God, it is right and proper to worship him at all times. And hear this. If you will do that, you will begin to win some spiritual battles that you desperately need to win. It's important that you win them. So I'm going to read as fast as I possibly can chapter 1 of the book of Job. I'm going to ask you to follow along, okay? And if I stumble over words, just correct them in your brain. Here they go. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. The man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 donkeys and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And this was his regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. By the way, the word Satan means accuser. Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? And Satan answered to the Lord, from roaming about the earth, going back and forth in it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and an upright man who fears God and shuns evil. Does Job fear God for nothing? Satan replied. Have you not put a hedge about him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread out throughout the land. But now, stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, very well then. Everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself, do not lay a finger. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day, the Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house. A messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them. They put your servants to the sword, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, another messenger came and said, the fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at your oldest brother's house, the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. At this, Job got up, tore his robe, shaved his head, and then he fell on the ground in worship and said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. And in all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Now, we're not going to take time to read Job chapter 2, but I'm going to say this. You probably know it. For Job, it goes from bad to worse. It gets even worse than this. And yet, he does not sin and say in his heart a curse against the Lord, charging him with wrongdoing. I want us to consider this fellow Job in Job 1 for a minute, and I want us to kind of look at him as the man. And I want you to understand his identity. And the first thing I want to tell you about him is he's not a bad guy. And it might seem silly that I have to say that because you know the story, but we are so ingrained in a system that says when you do something bad, then something bad's going to happen to you. And so if something bad happened to you, you must have done something bad. That's called karma, right? That's not a Christian doctrine at all, right? Grace is a Christian doctrine. Job is not getting what he deserves here, and you know that because you just heard me read verse 8. And you hear God's opinion of God, or of Job rather, where he says, there's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And so Job is not like some kind of guy who had this coming at all. Additionally, Job is not a pawn. And you might feel that he is. He may have felt a little bit like he was. You know what a pawn is in chess. If you play chess, if I were playing chess with someone and you took my pawn, I'd be like, ah, rats, you took my pawn. That's okay. You fell into my trap. Checkmate, you know? But I would be a little more distressed if you took my rook because I value rooks. I don't really value pawns as much as I value rooks. And someone might look at Job and say, well, you know, God kind of used him as a pawn to prove stuff to Satan, to beat Satan. And no, that's not true. If you understand the teaching here, you see that in God's eyes, Job is a treasure. That is why he brings him up. Satan, have you considered my servant Job? He is a treasure. He's the best of the best. I am so pleased with him. Well done, Job. Have you seen him, Satan? I got to tell you, if I'm Job, I'm kind of sorry that God brought that up, right? But understand, he didn't bring it up because he wanted to use Job as a pawn, but because he treasured Job and because he understood that Job was himself a very instrument of worship, capable of proclaiming the greatness of God. He's an image bearer. He bears the likeness of God in a beautiful way by the way he lives and just by the way he is. But what is really important to understand is that Job is every man. Job is you. Job is me. Because although none of us have encountered the greatness of loss that Job did, every one of us either has or will in our life numerous times say, I can really identify with Job. I feel his pain. Because that which Job endures is common to man. And in a sense, he is every man. And his role is to fulfill that identity by bringing glory to God. That's everyone's role, really. You know, the Westminster Shorter Catechism says the chief end of man, we'll say the chief end of humankind, is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. That's Job's job, that's your job, that's my job. I honestly, at this point in my life, have realized I don't think a person can be healthy, spiritually speaking, unless they begin to understand at least a portion of that reality. That your job, your purpose, your reason for being the chief end of man, humankind, is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. You were made by God. You were made with a purpose. And understand this, that just because someone might say the reason you're here is to glorify God, that does not diminish your ability to enjoy life. Sometimes, in a childish way, you might feel like, oh, I don't know if I want to glorify God. I think I want to have some fun of my own, right? I want my life to be my life. Who does God think he is asking me to glorify him? And you might have that disposition, that perspective sometimes, but I want to say to you this, that this purpose in life does not diminish your opportunity to enjoy life, but rather it guarantees that as you enjoy the life God gives you, you can find fulfillment and meaning in a way that otherwise you never will. And as long as we feel that the chief end of us is to make us happy, we will find great misery. But as we begin to grasp and own the truth that we are here to glorify God, we transition from misery to meaning to fulfillment. Job seems to have understood that somehow. He's understood the words of an early church father named Irenaeus. Irenaeus has this phrase that's attributed to him. Well, he said it. He wrote it down, actually. He was arguing about the humanity of God, of Jesus, rather. Jesus became fully human. And he said this, the glory of God is a human person fully alive. And so he was saying, so Jesus is a human person fully alive, and that brings glory to God. He was saying that to heretics that didn't believe Jesus was fully human. But you can take what he says there. The glory of God is a human being fully alive, and you begin to understand that when you fully live, that's when you glorify God. And if you want to fully live, then you will own the purpose of glorifying God. And until you will own the purpose of glorifying God, you'll never truly fully live. You are most fully alive when you're bringing glory to the one who gave you life. Job demonstrates that, or demonstrates a knowledge of it. Job really finds himself as a focal point in his cosmic wager. That's a Philippiansi phrase, cosmic wager. Satan and God are like betting almost on the outcome of this. And it seems as though God has actually staked his reputation on Job's behavior, his faithfulness. And by being faithful, he glorifies God. Job is really called upon to answer a great question: is the God of the Bible worth worshiping, worth following, even if he doesn't bless you? And we just read a moment ago in the text, Job worshiped God through the good times and the bad times. The first thing he does is prepare himself to go before the throne of God in worship. Now, it's easy to worship God when things are going well. Maybe we don't feel the need to when things are going well because we're so distracted by our pleasures. But it is difficult to worship him when things are going poorly. But if you want to win spiritual battles, you'll see that you have to. We can really learn a lot about a heart of worship if we look at Job's heart of worship, and it just unfolds in his last few verses in chapter 1 that we read. You can see that a heart of worship, Job's heart of worship, was real. He was authentic. Now, we do this thing, and we've talked about it before, that someone says, "How you doing?" You say, "Fine," right? "How you doing?" "Fine." "Yeah, okay." I'm kind of glad we do that, honestly, because I don't really care how you're doing, right? I mean, you say how you're doing when you really don't care how you're doing. And if someone really sits down and tells you, you're like, "Man, I got to be at the bus stop by 4 o'clock. And this guy's just talking and talking and talking and talking." We are of such a nature that we pretend we're interested in one another's lives on a level that we're not. And then we pretend everything's okay because we know that person really isn't interested. You never have to do that with God. Do you understand that? You never have to fake with God. He is not that way. He does not find the struggles that you're dealing with to be emotionally exhausting. You can be real with him, and he will not grow weary of hearing your heart. After he hears this devastating news, Job prepares to talk to God about it, and he's going to fall on the ground before he goes to the throne of God. I mean, look at verse 20 again. Listen to these verses again. "At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshiped. And said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised.'" Sometimes when I read that, I kind of skip over that business of him getting up and tearing his robe. I just think of the "naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And I forget, in advance of that, he kind of made himself ugly. He kind of made his outward appearance reflect what his heart was feeling. And I wonder if that was a little risky. Let me tell you why. Another Bible figure from ancient times is Nehemiah. Nehemiah is the kind of guy who finds himself in the throne room of the king every day. It's Nehemiah's job to make sure that the king's cup never goes empty. And so he's always making sure that the king has something to drink in his hand or at his hand. And one day when Nehemiah is going in there, he's feeling blue. He's sad because he's heard about what's going on in his hometown in Jerusalem, and he's sad. And it says in Nehemiah 2:2, "The king asked me, 'Why does your face look sad when you're not ill?' This can be nothing but sadness of heart." And catch these next five words: "I was very much afraid." What was Nehemiah afraid of? He was afraid because a servant was never to let his negative emotions show before a king, because that might suggest some kind of dissatisfaction with the king, and to do so would actually jeopardize that person's life. And yet Job is going before the King of Kings. How? He's going before God with his clothes torn. He's going before God with his head shaven. He's going before God covered with the dust of the ground. That could be risky. But here's what I see. It's not risky. Because you can worship God honestly. He does not want you to be fake happy. He wants your heart to be laid bare before him. And if you won't do this, you can't begin to win the spiritual battle that you're in. You've got to be honest with God. You've got to be real with him. But don't stop with that. Sometimes people stop with that. They go to God and they say, God, I can't believe what you did. Boy, I feel good that I got that off my chest. And that is not winning a spiritual battle. That is compounding a spiritual problem. But Job's heart was also a heart that was aware. It knew what it was doing. Sometimes when a crisis comes into my life or your life, we kind of react without realizing what we're doing. One time I was at camp, and I work in the office where we count the offerings and where we collect the bills. I was sitting in there, and there was money there before me because we were in business, we were open. I was alone in that office, and I heard a crash. And I looked down at the highway, and two trucks had hit head-on. The one glanced off the other, tipped over onto its side, and burst into flames. I had my cell phone in my hand, and I ran down toward the highway, calling 911, me and probably 50 other people running in that direction. I completely lost my head, because do you know what I left behind in the office? A lot of cash. I didn't need to go down there. There were people in front of me going down there. But the trauma and the crisis and the problem had caused me to lose awareness of what I was doing. And sometimes that can happen in our life, that a trauma come into our life and cause us to lose awareness, not just for a moment, but for a season. But Job doesn't do that. He has a heart that's aware. And although his clothing is torn, his head is shaven, he is covered with dirt, he's aware that he must not curse God. And he's aware that he shouldn't blame God. And he's aware that he must not call God's goodness into question. In all this, it says in verse 22, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Job was completely honest before God, but he was profoundly aware of who he was speaking to and who he was before the one he was speaking to. And that helps win spiritual battles when you're aware of who you're talking to as you worship. So your heart must be real, your heart must be aware, and your heart must be open. You can go to God in a time of crisis, in anger, and you can go in with clenched fists. You can go in with a heart that is hard and closed like a fist, and you can even shake your fist at God. And by His grace, for some reason, He doesn't hit you with a lightning bolt, because He's such a gracious God. You can do that, but that will not benefit you. Do you understand that? Staying in that posture with your heart closed in times of suffering will not help you. It will not cause you to win any battles. Meaningful worship doesn't come to God with clenched fists. It comes to God with an open heart. That's because worship is actually an expression of trust. I love you, and I trust you, God. And you can see expressions of trust sprinkled throughout the book of Job. For example, one of them is in Job 19, in verse 25. Job is speaking, and he says something so profound. Understand, Job is probably one of the oldest stories in the Bible, if not the oldest story in the Bible. And Job's life happened thousands of years before Jesus is born as Redeemer in Bethlehem. And yet Job expresses his faith and his trust and his confidence with an open heart, saying, I know that my Redeemer lives, and that He, in the end, that He will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see Him with my own eyes. I, and not another. How my heart yearns within me. Do you hear how open his heart is? Do you hear the sense of trust he has there and hope that he has there? Even when Job feels completely abandoned by God, even when he feels completely abandoned by God, he says this in chapter 23, but if I go to the east, God is not there. If I go to the west, I do not find him. When he is at work in the north, I don't see him. And When he turns to the south, I catch no glimpse of him, but he knows the way I take. And when he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. Do you hear the trust he has that gives him this open heart toward God? Those kind of verses tell me that Job, in the midst of all his trouble, did not allow his heart to become hard and bitter. He chose to trust God. And in doing that, he won spiritual battles. You think about the outcome of worship. And one of the first things that comes to my mind is, when I worship God, the enemy of my soul, the accuser, Satan, is put to shame. I never thought about it this week, but I thought, this is kind of cute, kind of funny, kind of great. Satan never shows up at the end of the book of Job. He's all over chapter 1 and 2. But when you get to the end, Satan is absent. He's not there. You know what he's like? He's like at the Super Bowl. On Friday, you know, your team's in the Super Bowl, and on Friday, there's that guy that cheers for the other team, and he's trash talking. Yeah, your team stinks. My team's going to win. You know, he's just running his mouth, right? And then Friday ends, Saturday, Sunday comes, and your team wins the Super Bowl, and you go to work Monday, and that guy called in sick. You know that guy, right? That's kind of what Satan is. It's like, rats! Job worshipped God and put me to shame. Satan is saying, he doesn't even bother to show up. He's AWOL. He's in hiding. Job's worship brought glory to God and therefore brought shame to our enemy. And when you glorify God, you bring shame to Satan. Better, you shame Satan by fulfilling your purpose, glorifying God and enjoying him forever. Another outcome is that the lover of your soul is honored. Jesus is honored when you worship in the midst of suffering. He loves you. He gave himself for you. How do you honor him? And you know, we honor people different ways. Maybe a statue in the park, their picture on a dollar bill or something like that. The way you honor Jesus is worship. You just worship him with your life. And when you worship Jesus, he is honored. And the third outcome is that you yourself find honor. That one day you'll hear, well done, my good and faithful servant. And those verses at the end where Job gets more than he had, that doesn't mean that God thinks it's okay to replace the puppy with a new puppy and everything will be hunky-dory. But what it means is that God honors those who honor him. And God's showing him honor. I'm a fair-weather Pirates fan, which means over the past 30 years, there's been about 2 months where I cheered, right? Wish Tim Snay was here to hear that, don't you? Yeah. And I hate to say this, but I'm a fair-weather Penguins fan, too. When they're winning, I'm all over it. I watch the games. I watch the stuff afterward. Now, some people think that's shameful. You know, since high school and college, I've heard people say, that's not a real fan. A real fan is... And I get that. Maybe so. But it's pretty trivial. It's sports, remember? So being a fair-weather fan, I don't have a problem with that. On the other hand, a fair-weather worshiper, that's kind of different, isn't it? It is downright shameful to worship God only when things are going my way, or only when I think he's going to do right in my estimation. But when you worship him in the dark, as well as worshiping him in the light, then you can hold your head high because he lifts your head high and honors you in similar ways that the closing verses of Job say that he honored Job. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful thing. When you choose to worship, God brings victory to your spiritual battles. We're going to have communion in a moment. But I want to ask you to take a look at the screen behind me. And I want to say, are you struggling to worship? I mean, when songs come up that talk about the goodness of God, is there something that catches in your throat and you say, oh, I don't know about that? Or do you don't even let it catch in your throat? I'm not going to sing those words. I can't right now. I want to encourage you that when you come to those seasons of your life, the most important thing you can do is be honest with God. Talk to Him about what you're feeling. But be aware that He's God and you're not, so don't have a fresh mouth, right? And be open with Him and open your heart, open your mouth, open your lips of praise, and give Him worship, and watch how He helps you turn a corner, and watch how He changes your life. I want to tell you something. I've known some of you for a long time, right? And therefore, I know some of the suffering that you have endured, far greater than anything I could speak about personally in my life. I want to tell those of you that don't have the privilege I have of looking out while the pastor's preaching, when I say words like these, when you're struggling, worship, and God will help you win a spiritual battle. The people who are sitting right out there who have had some of the greatest suffering are nodding the most emphatically. How cool is that? How cool is that? So take the heart of Job and make it your own and choose to have a heart of worship toward God.